Welcome to the deep dive. So today we're stepping away from the usual chat about hiring extra hands for the holidays. We're really getting into organizational survival, like the deep structural stuff needed to keep things running when your main workforce model just collapses. It's kind of the ultimate operational insurance. Our focus is what's called contingency staffing. And you should think of it less like HR calling up temps and more like, I don't know, a high stakes strategic defense. The big question is, when serious pressure hits, maybe a disaster, maybe a huge flu outbreak, or a major labor dispute, how does a company actually stabilize its output? How does it protect revenue and make sure it keeps its promises?
Exactly. And what's really key here, I think, is that the definition itself demands structure. It's not just winging it. Contingency staffing is, well, it's explicitly a structured response framework. It's engineered, really, to keep operations stable under extreme, unusual pressure. It's the backup system you deploy when, you know, your standard HR processes just can't cope anymore. And the success metric, it's pretty brutal. Did you keep things running when the system was basically set up to fail?
Okay, that immediately makes me think of like huge companies, manufacturers, utilities, right?
Yeah.
But the material you looked at suggests this kind of heavy-duty planning isn't just for the absolute worst-case disaster scenarios.
Mm-hmm.
What else triggers this kind of extreme staffing need?
Yeah, that's a great point. If you look closely, there are really four main types of disruption. And yeah, only one is the classic emergency. We often forget the others. First, and maybe the most intentionally disruptive one, is the organized work stoppage. So collective bargaining issues, strikes, lockouts, these are things people plan for, and they can shut down operations in hours. And they can last days, weeks, even months.
Right. And that's a massive headache, politically and financially, because it's not just an operational blip, it's public. Everyone sees it.
Exactly. The visibility is huge. But then second, you've got the less obvious, but potentially just as damaging, sudden workforce shortages. Think about big waves of illness, like a bad flu season, or unexpected spikes in people leaving, or even just, you know, ongoing really sharp shortages in specialized skills, especially when the job market's tight. You need people now faster than regular hiring can deliver.
Okay, so there are the sudden shocks. What about the disruptions that, well, aren't sudden at all?
That brings us to number three. Cyclical spikes. This is the demand you know is coming, but it's still overwhelming. Retail at Christmas, accountants during tax season, maybe seasonal weather patterns or market cycles. Contingency planning here lets the company match labor to that peak demand without, you know, hiring a ton of permanent staff they won't need in 6 months. It avoids that expensive bloat. And finally, number four, sometimes it's regulatory shifts. Maybe new compliance rules come in or new credentialing requirements. Suddenly, a chunk of your certified workforce might be temporarily sidelined until they get the new training or license. The business can't stop, but the pool of available qualified people just shrank overnight.
So bringing this all together for, you know, for you listening, the real risk here isn't just paying overtime to your exhausted regular staff. The real cost of getting this wrong is lost production, it's brand damage that can take years to repair, and it's failing to meet contracts you've signed. I mean, this really is about market survival, isn't it?
Oh, absolutely. The risk exposure is just massive, which is why companies have to treat this like building an operational blueprint, not just, you know, having a staffing agency on speed dial.
Okay, blueprint. Let's talk about that infrastructure. It almost sounds like you need a shadow army just waiting.
Mm-hmm.
That's got to be more than just a big database of names, right? What are the actual building blocks of a program that works?
You really need five core things for it to be truly effective. The first one is absolutely fundamental. Pre-qualified talent pools. This is the bedrock. And yeah, this is where the cost question often comes up. These are workers who are already screened, the credentials verified, ready to go, basically, without cutting corners on safety or skills.
Okay, hold on, though. Maintaining a pool of ready-to-go screen people, That sounds like keeping a permanent, expensive bench warm for something that might never even happen. How do you justify that cost?
Well, that's the strategic calculation, isn't it? You weigh the cost of maintaining that readiness against the potential cost of a complete operational shutdown. If shutting down for just 1 week costs you millions in lost revenue, penalties, reputational hits, suddenly that investment in readiness looks pretty smart. You're essentially buying operational time, and these pre-vetted pools drastically cut down the time it takes to get someone productive.
Okay, fair enough. What's element number two?
Second is scenario-based workforce planning. Sounds jargony, I know, but let's break it down. It's like running fire drills, but for staffing. Organizations need specific, detailed plans, like outlining the exact headcount needed, identifying the absolute critical job functions, figuring out geographic needs for different levels of disruption. Not just one plan fits all.
Ah, so you're not just planning for a crisis. You're planning for, say, a 30% staff reduction at Plant B, plus the main highway's closed. That's specific.
Precisely. Much more granular. Third is meticulous credential and compliance management. This is non-negotiable. Contingency workers have to meet the exact same standards, licensing, safety certs, everything, as your permanent team. If your paperwork isn't perfect and ready, you lose critical time getting people activated. Bureaucracy can kill you here.
Got it. Credentials locked down. What's next?
Fourth, logistics and deployment coordination. Honestly, this is often the weakest link in the chain. This covers all the infrastructure for getting people where they need to be, especially if they're traveling. So, coordinating transport, finding lodging, setting schedules, handling on-site orientation. The efficiency of your logistics dictates how fast you can actually reinforce your operations.
Okay, logistics is huge. And the last piece.
And finally, number five. You absolutely need on-site supervision and support. You need supervisors embedded with these contingency teams. Their job is to make sure everyone's aligned operationally, solve problems on the fly, especially when people are doing complex work in places they don't know, under potentially stressful or even volatile conditions.
Right, that logistics and deployment piece and the supervision, that feels especially critical in the toughest scenario, a strike. When tensions are sky high, everything's under a microscope. The way you operate has to be incredibly disciplined, right? What changes tactically in that kind of environment?
Yeah, that really brings up the issue of stability when things are volatile.
Yeah.
You definitely can't just run business as usual. First thing you do is implement role prioritization. You identify those absolutely critical functions that cannot stop, the ones where pausing causes structural damage, maybe safety risks, or it's a very hard call, but it's necessary to prevent total collapse. Second, you often need task simplification. Processes might get temporarily modified. The sources call this transitional training. It doesn't mean doing shoddy work. It means focusing the contingency workers only on the core essential workflows and tasks they can do safely and quickly. You don't try to teach them the entire permanent role overnight.
Can you give me a quick example of that simplification? Like, are we talking about changing the physical workflow or just giving them a simpler checklist to follow?
Often, it's a bit of both. Maybe it involves using simplified software interfaces for certain tasks, or strictly limiting the range of products they handle on a line, focusing only on the main ones. The goal is reducing the mental load and complexity to boost speed and safety under pressure. And third, absolutely critical in strike situations are strict safety and conduct protocols. Contingency workers need clear rules. Operate in designated safe zones, maintain professional neutrality. They're there to do a job, not get drawn into the conflict, especially with high tension and public scrutiny.
Okay, but if you're simplifying tasks, bringing in outside labor, how do you actually maintain quality and productivity at a level that stabilizes things? You surely can't expect the exact same output as your experienced permanent team.
That's a key question. And what's interesting is that quality isn't just about individual skill. It's maintained through that structured oversight we talked about. It leans heavily on those on-site supervisors. They're providing direct, real-time coaching, watching performance metrics closely, maybe even adjusting staffing between tasks hour by hour. And yes, productivity standards might be temporarily adjusted to reflect reality, you know, the learning curve. But the primary goal is stabilization, keeping things moving safely and within regulations, not necessarily hitting peak performance records immediately.
Let's dig a bit more into those logistics, because if you're moving workers across states, maybe even internationally, that time gap between saying, okay, you're hired, and that person actually being productive on site, that's where companies can just bleed money, right? This sounds less like HR and more like, I don't know, a military deployment.
That time to productivity metric is absolutely critical. It can be the difference between a successful intervention and, frankly, costly failure. For traveling labor, the logistics have to be almost military grade, like you said, ironclad. Lodging needs to be arranged close to the worksite. Minimizing commute time maximizes rest and work time. You need coordinated shift rotations, mandatory ones to fight fatigue. Often, you'll need dedicated transport arranged, because asking someone new to navigate an unfamiliar city under stress first thing, that's just asking for delays.
Makes sense. What else?
And maybe most important, that new worker needs direct contact with their supervisor the moment they arrive. Eliminate uncertainty. Uncertainty breeds hesitation. Hesitation means delay. And delay costs you throughput, output, money. The cost of getting logistics wrong isn't just the wasted plane ticket, it's the day or two of unproductive downtime you paid for while waiting for them to get oriented.
Wow, okay, that level of intense coordination, it really does sound like a full-time specialty.
Yeah.
Is this where dedicated external partners come in? Like the source mentioned a company, RSS Inc., firms that only do this.
Absolutely. That's a huge advantage for many organizations, partnering with specialists in these rapid deployment solutions, because they don't just bring the people, they bring the whole system. The pre-vetted network, the tested deployment coordination, and crucially, those experienced on-site field managers who know how to maintain discipline in chaotic situations. They're experts at managing the chaos, essentially, and the sources are really clear on this. You get the best results when you engage these partners during the planning stage, months, maybe years before any potential crisis. If you wait until a strike is called or disaster hits, you're facing delays, lower availability of the best people, and paying emergency premium rates. Proactive is key.
Right. That makes total sense. Plan ahead, don't wait for the fire. Okay, let's shift gears slightly. What about the people already working there, your permanent staff?
Mm.
When you bring in an external contingency force, how does that land with them? What's the impact on morale on the company culture?
That's a really sensitive area, and transparency is absolutely vital for keeping trust. Your internal teams need clear, honest, consistent communication about why this is happening, why contingency staff are needed, and ideally, how long it's expected to last. Good communication helps manage anxiety and stops the rumor mill, which can be really destructive. And also, critically, safety rules have to apply equally to everyone. Existing staff and contingency workers operate under the exact same non-negotiable safety standards. That maintains cohesion and obviously reduces risk.
Okay, so communication and unified safety. Then once the crisis passes, the storm ends, the strike settles. How do you transition back to normal? How do you avoid creating a new kind of disruption during that handoff period?
Yeah, the reintegration needs its own plan too. It's often overlooked. First, you need formal handoff briefings. The outgoing contingency supervisors need to properly brief the returning permanent managers. Share what happened, what changed, any ongoing issues. Knowledge transfer is key. Second, you need a gradual, phased reduction of the supplemental labor. You can't just switch them off overnight. That can cause its own dip in operations. You scale down smoothly. And third, something often missed, a return-to-work orientation for your permanent staff. Especially if any processes or workflows were simplified or changed during the disruption, they need to be brought up to speed so they don't walk back into a system they don't quite recognize. Avoids confusion and friction. You know, if you step back and look at the whole cycle, having this capability provides really significant strategic advantages. First, negotiation stability. Knowing you can maintain operations reduces pressure during difficult labor talks. And second, operational scalability. It gives you the power to ramp capacity up or down almost instantly in response to market demands or disruptions. Ultimately, it shifts the whole organization from being reactive and vulnerable to being proactive and ready. It's a posture of readiness.
Okay, so let's try and wrap this up for you. This whole deep dive really shows that contingency staffing isn't just another recruiting tactic, not at all. It's a serious continuity discipline. It's defined by its structure, its need for rapid deployment capability, and how much it relies on dedicated, really integrated on-site supervision, especially when the pressure is at its absolute max. That's what makes it fundamentally different from just calling a standard temp agency.
Precisely. And maybe a final thought for you to consider drawing from this. You know, operations under intense crisis often shine a really bright light on systemic weaknesses or inefficiencies, things that were maybe hidden during normal, stable times. So the strategic takeaway could be, how can you use the data, the observations, the performance metrics gathered during a crisis to find unexpected ways to improve your processes long term? Things you might never have spotted otherwise.
That's a great point, using that moment of maximum stress as a catalyst for future improvement. Definitely something to think about. Maybe take a moment yourself and consider, what would be the 5 most critical roles in your organization if everything went sideways tomorrow with zero notice? Thanks for joining us for the deep dive.